Guys, I'm pumped to do a podcast with you. I'm really pumped.
Me too.
I'm really excited. Let's go.
I love doing this stuff.
Let's go. I wish you weren't a liar.
Let's go.
Oh. You just like caressed my hand there for like, a second. Hey. I was looking at here and he fist bumped my hand. I was like, what is David doing?
Ew, David.
Ew, David.
Touched your hand.
Oh my God. Ew, David.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Human Reaction. We are glad to have you here. Please like, subscribe, and follow on whatever podcast platform you're listening on or watching on. And if you'd like to become a member and get access to our exclusive members-only content like The Skiff, our members-only show, go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how.
And also, so you don't wake up from a nightmare, much like what I have here, John Bolton waking up from a nightmare, make sure to join our Discord.
For those audio-only listeners.
I think it works. Yeah, we have John Bolton wakes up from terrifying nightmare of world peace, and he looks distraught.
From mustache. The Discord.
That's good Photoshop.
The mustache man himself.
There's no way that mustache looks that good first thing in the morning.
Oh, I bet it does.
I don't know. He's got quite the stash.
You don't think he wakes up with bed stash?
It's one of the only good things about him.
That's right. It is his most impressive quality.
It is, really. All right, what are we doing today, Dave?
We're doing a tour around the globe. We've been covering U.S. politics and development so much. You know, we just want to get a look around about what's the rest of the world up to? And it doesn't look great, guys.
It's terrifying.
Except for something. We got some highlights. We got some lowlights. A little bit of both.
Some Argentinian white pills.
Yeah.
Freshly imported.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As World War III is starting, there is a gem in the rough.
that's one way to frame it.
You have to soften the blow with some cool things that are happening around the world, right?
Yeah. Argentina's inflation is down. That's great.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Let's hope they get to continue doing that.
If you are a small business owner looking for exponential growth, you have to connect with Adam Thune at Intellectual Patriots. He will revolutionize your business game and help you get to the next level. Adam can streamline your business practices and advertising strategies to improve your bottom line. His expertise in data engineering means he can build you the systems you need to collect and analyze market data. His mission is to provide you with invaluable insights to fuel your success. From grant writing and business proposals to digital systems integrations, even AI management, Intellectual Patriots is a one-stop shop for cutting-edge solutions. Don't wait another second. Visit intelpatriots.com to learn more. That's intelpatriots.com.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com, that's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
So we're jumping into new escalations in Ukraine versus Russia, right? What's going on here for it, guys?
So the classic lame duck institution, right? The tradition in American presidencies, after the election, there's usually a gap in time there where the president that's currently sitting there is on his way out, a new one's coming in. There's a lot of very formal collaboration that happens in this time frame, especially on controversial issues. It's very traditional for the president not to take major deviations from the obvious oncoming regime, because what you don't want to do is set up the new American president with a bunch of problems to handle as they're coming in.
Unless that incoming president is Donald Trump. In which case, maybe you do.
Then you want to create all the problems.
In which case, you start World War III. Yeah.
But that's also kind of what happened in 2016, right? Russia, this stuff, right? Yeah. Like they just came in with all these new sorts of problems that all of a sudden that we had to deal with on the get-go.
So if this were a standard continuation of sort of like the, you know, the American presidential establishment model, that would be the way things would go. It would be very smooth. They try to like create a seamless handoff. But in this case, because Trump is ostensibly going to upend everything the establishment stands for, they want to basically, you know, throw all the roadblocks in his way that they possibly can.
That's one way to interpret it. Yeah. Or you interpret it as the Biden administration, in pursuit of making sure that the eventual Ukrainian deal that's going to happen, it was going to happen no matter what. at some point. There's just no way they were going to get their pipe dream of repelling all Russian troops back to the traditional borders of Ukraine. That's not going to happen. So granted that, what can they do to try to set that up for the best opportunity for negotiations? At some point, you have to maintain the Kursk region so that Russia has something that they're going to get out of that negotiation. Hopefully, therefore, they don't have to give as much.
Right.
Makes sense?
Yes.
So what happened this week is the Biden administration approved the use of U.S. ATACMS, A-T-A-C-M-S rockets. It's literally called ATACMS.
I know.
Someone said that, I was like, there's no way that's what they call it.
I know. The only thing I can think of when I hear ATACMS is Steakums, like those little like meat strips. They have the best Twitter account ever. You have to follow Steakums Twitter. It's amazing.
Shout out Steakums.
Shout out Steakums. Every time I hear ATACMS, I'm like, that's just the most unserious name ever.
Now, that's a sponsor we should get. Little meat steak strips. That
yeah, awesome. Dude, Steakums.
Yeah. Oh man, yeah,
Steakums. Hit us up.
Well, after we gave them this free promo, they don't need it.
That's right. This episode brought
we'll
to
talk
you
about
Steakums
every week. That sounds good to
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely.
I'll talk about steak. So we got a little recap from Zero Hedge here. As you know, this is the deployment range of these rockets. They can fire further into Russian territory. That's the real danger. Now, at the same time, actually, just prior to this, Russian news, Russia reworked their nuclear policy, basically say that they may respond with nukes if attacked by a country that doesn't have nukes. If that country is receiving support from the U.S. and the nation is threatened. So basically saying they can now interpret these kind of threats to the interior of Russia as potentially warranting a nuclear response. Yeah. So the potential there is how far in they can go and what damage they can cause. The question, and obviously the narrative here is if Russia attacks, you know, responds with nuclear, what would that look like?
Yeah.
Great visualization here from Russian television of demonstrating the kind of target range that they could respond to strike back at NATO. Right? Because note here, what they're seeing is as these rockets that we are now using, the ATACMS, ATACMS rockets, they require U.S. military personnel to run and operate, right? U.S. military personnel have to give the intel. They run the machines around it. It's a highly sophisticated rocket. Therefore, you know, they could interpret this as not Ukraine attacking them. This is United States and NATO attacking them.
And also Britain directly as well, firing their Storm Shadow missiles just a day or two ago as well.
Exactly.
So
right.
Multiple NATO members now actively kind of really directly engaging in this conflict. And then, yeah, just for those audio only listeners, we've just been watching a video basically showing that all of the major European capitals are within proximity of Russian missiles should they decide to retaliate in some
danger
really
zone
meaningful way.
Yeah, they're also attacking, zone, yes. Like talking about very specific ports that they'd strike,
military
places,
installations,
yeah, places in the UK. It's
basically they said like Great Britain would be completely demolished if they decided to strike. And obviously this is Russian TV, so they're going to try to be projecting the most strength they possibly can. Mm-hmm. But I mean, these are real threats that exist.
Yeah, so that's the interpretation. This means World War III, right? That's how the narrative has been carried. At least the Biden administration's advocation of that, and that to bog down Trump as the other kind of component of that. We have, you know, what these mean could be the first steps in the escalatory spiral to take us to the next place, which would involve all of NATO versus directly engaged with Russia.
Yeah.
We also have a tweet here from Dmitry Medvedev, who is the deputy chair of the Security Council at Russia. Russia's new nuclear doctrine means NATO missiles fired against our country could be deemed an attack by the bloc on Russia. Russia could retaliate with WMD against Kiev and key NATO facilities wherever they're located. That means World War III. So this is a pretty powerful figure in the Russian government on the Security Council.
Well, and one of the things that you can't, because we think of Putin in our mind is a right-wing figure, right? But it should be noted that in Russia, he's not necessarily considered the furthest right you can be.
Yeah.
There are plenty of people in Russia who are far more radically opposed and more aggressive in their posture internationally against NATO. There's a lot of anger about the entire scenario that led up to this point, understandably. And if you're someone who has a son, a nephew, a grandson, whatever, that has died on the front lines in Ukraine over what you feel is not a war of conquest, but rather a war to make sure you're not conquested. I didn't use that word.
Conquered.
Right. Conquered. I wanted the mirror, you know?
Like it
didn't
like
work well. Anyway, so
I know words. I had the best words.
Exactly. That it's understandable that you might get to a very radical position where you're hovering over that tactical deployment of nuclear weapons. Now, the problem there, and the Russians realize this too, is that there is just that logic of the minute they launch, what's going to happen afterwards. One of the things that, this has been interpreted as is this bogging down of the Trump administration. So why would he do it now is the question. Good Morning Liberty has this interesting tweet here on it.
So we have an article here from Ukraine fired U.S.-made missiles into Russia for first time. And the question here is, why would Biden do this on his way out the door after saying no for over 2 years? Occam's razor suggests the simplest answer is usually correct. If Kamala had won, the military contractors were guaranteed hundreds of billions more over several years. Trump puts that in jeopardy. The goal is to escalate this to the point that Trump has no choice but to fight a war and ensures the weapons manufacturers get their payday.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this is basically to try to put the wheels in motion so that Trump can't possibly back his way out of this. Mm-hmm. But I just saw a headline a day or two ago that suggested that Putin was open to negotiations for peace if Trump were the one doing the negotiating. Mm-hmm. Is that something that can be done? During this lame duck period, can Trump kind of be the diplomat that handles that peace talk?
No. I mean, can he start talking to him? Yeah.
And he has been. He's,
yeah.
I think he's...
But can he do anything formal? No, that requires him to be...
Has he already had a conversation with Putin? I feel like... wasn't.
I feel like there's
public?
Been reporting on that.
I feel like there's been... Maybe it was just other leaders.
Well, though. I know Elon did. I know they were reporting on that.
Elon did.
Yeah.
No, Elon did with Iran, I thought. Didn't he have a conversation with Iran?
I think it's Russia.
Pretty sure it was Iran.
That'd be even wilder.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's a theory, and I think it's at minimum use the rockets so we have to build more. Right? Yeah. I mean, if you're looking at the incentive structure of the military industrial complex, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But whether or not that really commits Trump to a long term war in Ukraine, I think when you look at the targets picked and the response from Russia, including that kind of overture from Putin, it might take it a slightly different direction. That said, you can't underestimate the military-industrial complex and the national security architecture's confidence in the mad theory. And I have this Piers Morgan, Joe Walsh. We got our boy Dave Smith on the panel, but I really want to talk about Piers's and obviously Joe Walsh, who was a former Republican from the 1990s and early 2000s. No, mid-2000s. Kind of nodding along to this, what their view of how confident they are that anything America does will not be responded with in an escalation from Russia.
On camera yesterday, Putin and said, if you guys launch anything, I'm going to use nuclear capability.
Yeah, but hang on,
enough of this BS.
Vinny, hang on. You talk about BS. He has threatened to use nuclear weapons from day one of this war. And guess
day
what?
One.
Every time the West has actually crossed one of his so-called red lines, he's done nothing. I don't think there's any chance that Vladimir Putin is going to press a nuclear button. Because you know why? He would be vaporized along with his country in 30 nanoseconds. So if you think about it logically, this guy's not an Islamic fundamentalist. He's not going to risk his own life, right, for some great cause. He's not that way minded. He's a megalomaniac oligarch who's built $100 billion personal empire out of being a former KGB thug who now runs the country in the same way. But this idea that he's going to press a button that signals MAD, as they call it, MAD, mutually assured destruction, why would he do that? So why do we keep allowing him to rattle his nuclear saber rather than it being what it should be, which is a deterrent against being attacked, as an offensive weapon to stop people getting involved? Why do we allow him to do that? When did Republicans, like you, Vinny, I say this with great respect, you know I love you.
Yeah.
But when did Republicans...
I love you too.
When did Republicans start to just back off Russian dictators and want them to win? Which is effectively what would happen here if we let Ukraine go and don't help them.
What are your thoughts, David?
At least a part of this that I don't think that he's including is escalatory spirals and right. how they happen. Additionally, we've been very close in the past, within minutes of launching a nuclear war. There's a time during the Cuban Missile Crisis where a singular person on a singular submarine said, wait, I don't think the Americans are launching. And that was it. That was it. One Russian guy, some low-level dude, running a radar being like, wait a minute, that actually the signature isn't what I thought it was at first. That's how close we are. One submarine can't get communication for some reason Yikes. Or whatever and presses the button. Humanity's, at least in the North, wiped out.
Right.
Well, it's also just in terms of World War III, when World War I kicked off, it all happened with a single spark, which was the Archduke Ferdinand assassination. But there was also decades of escalation that was happening up until that moment, to the point where once that happened, then all hell broke loose. Mm-hmm. But there was all these like, oh, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. Oh, no, it's not happening. And that went on for decades right. until the moment.
And the biggest danger here is because of the Patriot missile system's capabilities, Russia doesn't necessarily know any next missile isn't going to be nuclear tipped. And if you're that close to the button at all times, mm-hmm. you might have the ICBMs go off, right? And because you just misinterpreted something. That the reliability of that architecture is rife with potential unintended consequences and mistakes. We've been there before. We can go there again. And underweighing that in the intensity of that moment, the long tail on that risk is enormous. It's literally civilization. Right, it's a famous Albert Einstein quote. I don't know. I can't tell you what World War III will look like, but I know World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's also it doesn't help with the saber rattling going on from guys like Joe Walsh on here, who's like he's kind of made a name for himself for being like the anti-Trump Republican type of guy. I think he ran for president in 2020. I think he was in the primaries, wasn't he? I think he, but he just like failed completely.
Yeah.
But earlier on in this interview, he was going off on this massive rant about Tulsi being a Russian asset, mm-hmm. and Dave Smith just absolutely demolished him. But his entire talking points was she's saying exactly what Russia would say, and because she's saying we shouldn't go to war with Russia, so that's saying exactly what Putin would
How
say.
How dare you?
And therefore, she's an asset. And it's like it's the dumbest argument I've ever heard in my life.
And this is another typical like running on the meme or running on like a stereotype of Republicans, right? It doesn't, what we know about Reagan, you know, the meme of Reagan, like the image that we have is he was really strong. He said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. Mm-hmm. What we forget is that when running simulations about what would happen in a nuclear strike, he refused to respond repeatedly.
Meaning, knowing
it's a simulation, are flying towards America, and he had the button there. He's supposed to do the code thing and do the other person thing and press the button. He just basically wouldn't.
Reagan wouldn't.
Yeah, because he didn't want to end civilization.
Fair.
Yeah. Right. And his point was, I'm never going to let it get here.
Right.
It can't get here.
Right.
Because if it's gotten here, we've all failed.
Yeah.
And that
was
like,
there was a moment in history where he had the opportunity to press the button because it was confusing about, I can't remember the exact situation of why it was, but there was like pigeons that landed somewhere and they thought that a bunch of Russian missiles had gone off, and he was sitting there and he's just like, I'm not going to do it. And there was also another scenario with Gorbachev, who was also in that position, and he also chose not to do it.
Mm. So,
but the question is, do we have, given what guys like Piers Morgan and Joe Walsh are saying in this interview and others inside of, you know, the existing administration have said and done, do we have leaders with that kind of restraint at the helm right now? Well, other than Putin, clearly, who's like actively under attack and not using nukes.
Well, that's the thing about the MAD strategy is he's like, he's a megalomaniac. He's all these things. So therefore, he's completely reliable and we can guarantee he will be restrained. Which is it? Which is it, Piers? Is he a crazy megalomaniac or is he the restrained person in this situation?
You're full of shit.
Keeping
today.
Us from escalating into World War III.
That's actually the thing, is like, it feels to me that World War III is being stopped at this moment purely by the restraint of Putin.
And that's like the worst place you want to be in, right?
Yeah.
The last place you want to be in is where the autocrat is the person keeping that from happening. That's so against the American ideal. But that's where these people have put us.
Well, I have to imagine, though, that right now, knowing that Trump's coming into office, Putin is like, if we can just hang on for the next couple months, we will be able to end this and keep civilization alive. Right?
That seems to be how I'm interpreting as well. Is like, and Trump puts this out there all the time. Is like, you can tell Trump is terrified of nuclear war, and it's like he's seen classified stuff. He's seen what the potential of the weaponry is, and all the weaponry that we don't even probably know that exists. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at it, and he is constantly warning, but without saying particularly the details. It seems like he's just like, guys, we do not want to go there.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people that seem to want to just push us towards the line as close as possible to be able to get their weapons deals and to be able to get all this stuff, right? Yeah.
And I really think that's a big part of the logic here, right? Is they know Trump is going to go in and end this thing. Therefore, they're going to do what they can to spend all that money as they can. Now, the white pill here is that the Russians shut down almost all of them with one hitting a remote area with no casualties. So that's the white pill. Beyond that, they seem to have been deployed in support of the Kursk offensive. Now, we covered this back in the summertime, and this was kind of the Battle of the Bulge of sorts for Ukraine, where they kind of pushed into some Russian territory that wasn't really under contention, bringing it into contention, and therefore having to realign Russian forces in order to defend and go on the defense. It's a sensible strategy. So in support of that, what that tells me is that's probably to set up negotiations to be as favorable as possible for the United States.
Yeah.
And NATO and Ukraine on the settlement. But what they're going to get probably is, I don't see any future where it doesn't come with a guarantee of substance that Ukraine has never put into NATO. Right. Otherwise, this war continues, because I just don't think Russia can tolerate anything short of that.
I mean, I think you're right. Like, knowing what we know about all of the sort of failures to uphold our sides of that very agreement, dating back all the way to the late 80s, early 90s, I don't know how Putin could trust a promise like that, mm-hmm. honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just sort of, it's weird. Like, of course he would guarantee that, or of course he would want that guarantee, but could he trust that the West would uphold it, because we've failed to do so a dozen times?
Yeah, what happens 4 years later?
Yeah.
Yeah, the challenge is that he's never gotten it in writing. And there are treaty negotiation tactics you can use to try to lock something in more firmly, right? And therefore impose penalties if it doesn't. And there are international reputation problems there that can come into play for America. Now the question is with nutcases like this, you know, with like Piers Morgan on this, how do you guarantee any amount of American reliability on their side? Because hegemony is such a powerful doctrine in the United States.
Yeah.
And then also, what's going on? So I got a tweet pulled up here, is that very quietly the Biden administration is attempting to forgive half of the Ukraine aid loans.
Yeah.
What is going on? So we gave a bunch of money and it's meant to be a loan, quote unquote.
That's how they sold
it. And now they're just going to forgive most of it.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't necessarily a loan. Like, that's just an aid package then.
Well, it also,
that's charity.
That's charity.
Think with like, if you're British and you're still paying on World War II loans and shit, you know what I mean? And we're like, that's, you know, not trivial, but we're like, no worries, Ukraine. You don't have to spend. They gave the contracts to BlackRock, so why would they need to replay the loan, right?
Exactly.
Man, those trips to America that Zelensky makes, they pay off.
They really
do. Really pay off.
They really do.
I don't know what he's doing behind the scenes there, but.
You don't?
I don't know. Some people are saying things.
But I plead the fifth.
So this is another like last minute, you know, policy that Trump probably wouldn't do, to lock it into a certain direction. Now, can he rescind this at some? I don't know. I'm not really sure. I haven't got to dive into the authority language of it. But heck of a development, and definitely suggests that a big part of this is to undermine the ability of the Trump administration to take this in a different direction. And the last part of that, and this is news from this morning, so not everything's confirmed yet, but just to get on top of it. In response to these strikes, the Federation launched a new strike deep into Ukraine, a city named Dnipro?
Dnipro.
Dnipro. That was close.
Maybe the D is silent. I'm not sure.
Dnipro. Make it sound Ukrainian. Ukraine claims that they were ICBMs, which is very dangerous, right? That would be the first use of ICBMs ever. Right, we've had the technology, but it's never been fired. Right, ICBMs are intercontinental ballistic missiles. They are the ones that we built the Cold War strategy around, where we can fire from Alaska into St. Petersburg,
like, right? Over the North Pole.
Yeah, 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 they are very long range. So they reported it was ICBMs. There, if you go on X right now, you're going to find a bunch of stuff all about how they're all ICBMs and just kind of reporting that as if it was fact. That was Ukrainian officials saying that. So when you see that, that's probably pro-Ukraine account. What U.S. officials are claiming, according to the New York Times and several other Washington Post, a couple other places, is that these are a new intermediate range ballistic missile. And a big part of this, too, is if you watch the videos of these, you'll find like this, like almost looks like rains of fire coming down of multiple missiles. So it's probably like an intermediate range missile that shoots up, launches out a bunch of missiles, and then attacks a target. Reportedly, these targets were in this area specifically to attack Patriot missile systems, which themselves are used for missile defense, and then additional, which weren't stopped in this case, which is interesting, and then are used for offensive missile capabilities.
Is there a reason why they wouldn't have been stopped if that's what the Patriot missiles are for?
They might have been hypersonic, too fast or not detected in time or stealth. I mean, we don't know. And the article I saw literally says the West was not aware that they had this technology.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, at least they hadn't seen it deployed in the war before. It was vague about whether or not they knew this technology existed.
Would there be a rationale for why the West would not stop that attack? Continued escalation.
Like they let it happen?
Yeah.
I don't know. We don't have casualty figures or anything like that yet, so I'm not sure. It depends.
Interesting.
Yeah, because sometimes that is the tactic to continue to escalate things. It's just you hold off.
Let them hit you.
Let them hit some sort of point that doesn't have a bunch of casualties, but they're like, oh, now this means war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more saber-rattling.
Could see that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Still developing. We'll see. So, meanwhile, in the rest of Europe, in the UK, British people are imprisoning people for social media. And that's...
World War III is going on. The British are like, you made a bad post on Facebook.
Wasn't very nice.
Wasn't very nice. That's going to be 1.5 years.
So we got here, this is the guy from Mumford & Sons, right?
Yeah, he's a singer. He's become like
he's the banjo player.
Or he's the banjo player, singer. Yeah. He's become a right-wing podcast host.
I watched a couple of his interviews. Pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Let's get him on.
I used to love Mumford and Sons. Back in high school, I listened to them all the time. They were my climbing playlist.
Hell yeah, brother.
Hell yeah, brother. Wow.
Hit the gay button for me real quick.
No, fuck you. Mumford and Sons is good.
Yeah, I got Bennett on my side. Get out of here, Joe.
David, you like metal, right?
Yeah, I don't trust.
I also
don't
like
trust
metal.
Bluegrass.
I also like metal. You can like multi. I like hip hop. I like metal.
I know. Just not Mumford & Sons. Okay, go ahead and play the clip.
Guy's got a great hairline.
Are you jealous, Dave?
No. A bald supremacist.
Yeah, no, you're pretty free. Like, you're very free.
Mm-hmm. Actually, a week ago, my lawyer back home called me up and said two of your tweets are technically illegal. You could be arrested when you return. That's not a joke. They've been clearing out the prisons. Mm-hmm. To put in people now for literally Facebook memes. There's someone in prison right now. They cleared out the prisons, by the way, and actual offenders, criminal, violent offenders. One person reoffended the day he left.
Mm-hmm.
There's one guy in prison for a Facebook meme for 3 months. There's one woman who's doing 2.5 years for a tweet. Right? The free speech is in utter peril. It's a disgrace. It's not just England. It's the whole of Europe. It's unbelievably concerning. What you hear from England, it's worse as well because 55% of conservative voters wanted Kamala to win. Mm. So even the British right is so much further left than it is over here. We're in real trouble. Don't give up on us, please. Don't punish us for our terrible leaders.
What kind of soup do you have over there?
Wow, guys. I mean, we kind of saw this coming, right? Like we were seeing the introduction of all these like different hate speech social media bills happening through Europe. And I mean, especially with the riots that were going on around immigration in Ireland and Scotland and the UK as well. Now it's just been, seems like it's been codified and now they're actually executing on some of these rules.
Yeah.
It's terrifying because it's not just happening in the UK. This seems to be happening all across the Europe, but also places like Australia, New Zealand, you're starting to see these types of things happen. We saw these during the COVID regime, massive crackdowns that happen here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an interesting framework of they're releasing prisoners and then they're imprisoning like their own people, you know, like just kind
for
of
speech.
People for speech.
Yeah.
Like violent prisoners are being released, but then like free speech violations or speech violations are going in.
Yeah.
That's the... like the twisted upside down world that we exist in right now.
One white pill is I do hear the Australian bill has died.
Like, oh, it's no longer has the support. Enough people came out on the independent side to fight it. But
I hope COVID woke a lot of people up in Australia, because things got a little crazy there in Aussie land.
We'll see.
They did.
We do have also like Brazil and all these other places. This new regime that's leaning into the censorship industrial complex from the policy side of governments is a very concerning development.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, without that, at least without the very tip of that, the very top of that, without the intelligence agency's injection of capital and research and all this kind of stuff into the CIC, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. It's not just that it's affecting Britain or Australia or Brazil. I mean, it's a global phenomenon that does impact Americans and American companies, particularly given the fact that that the UK is going to be summoning Elon to answer for being a, you know, having basically his platform be a part of the summer riots that occurred previously. And Mike Benz has talked about this, right? How the EU Digital Services Act is so nefarious, because basically if X is not allowed to operate in Europe, which is like 500 million people versus, you know, our 350 million people, like that's fairly existential for the platform of X, right? Like they can't exist without that market on their platform. They would effectively
yourself.
Exactly.
They would effectively
no longer be a global platform. And so like that would impact our availability of X in this country, because if they can't exist, X isn't here. Mm-hmm. So what happens in England is not irrelevant to what's happening in the US.
There's also a theory there of why Zuckerberg might be making the shift too, where he's like, I'm a libertarian now, you know, that whole deal. Is because he needs the leverage of the U.S. State Department to help combat and do lobbying efforts in the EU for the sake of like this digital privacy bill and all of these free speech things that are going to make it impossible to run a global social media network in Europe.
So, yeah, and currently the current regime is obviously not lobbying on behalf of internet free speech. But perhaps
so you have to take control of the State Department, because that's like the big area where we're talking about diplomatic efforts.
Right. And perhaps Zuckerberg saw the writing on the wall with a probable Trump win and a changing of the guard there that might be more, helpful in backing up U.S. companies operating in Europe to sort of override some of these things or put pressure on those governments to not try to crack down on them.
Yeah. And it feels to me like everything that's happening right now, the massive culture shift that's going on, and also kind of the new technology seems to be winning, like the creative destruction is happening right now. I think that we're probably going to end up seeing these reversals happen over time of all this pushback that is kind of from like the Davos mindset of the world that is trying to really crack down on free speech. That seems to be going on the out right now. And I think it was just like they overplayed their hands in both COVID and all these elections that are happening right now. And just because the internet exists, and especially because Elon bought Twitter and has made it such a free speech platform, there's still its problems, but it's so much better than anything else that exists right now. I think that you're just like you're seeing the wake up call that's happening, and all these riots that are forming. You know, you have like the farmers' protests in the Netherlands. You have all of we've covered the Ireland stuff going on. French. It's like all these. You have massive elections like Italy, the prime minister of Italy. Mm-hmm. All of these are, you know, it's showcasing the trend of where I think things are going. And there's just a massive, massive shift. It's like the 20th century regime that took place, like this globalist regime thing that's going on, this like neoliberal thing that is crumbling right now because they've lost the culture. They can't maintain the mono narratives anymore.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the question from here is, where is the U.S. State Department going to feed into this in terms of that? And we have this tweet from Mike Benz, which I think is totally right. I cannot begin to tell you how important the post of U.S. ambassador to the U.K. is going to be in this administration. It's existential, and we need an absolute monster in there.
Yeah.
Completely agree. That's right. And that post in U.K. and U.K. relations, there's so much there, too. If we see Reform U.K. pick up, you know, more in the next election cycle, we could look at things like free speech, changes in the UK to things like a free trade agreement between the US and UK. That's both Nigel Farage and Trump have kind of suggested that. So we have a lot of opportunity there, I think, in US-UK relations.
I do find it funny because a lot of this started because Elon's getting summoned to the UK, and he tweeted out, they will be summoned to the United States to explain their censorship and threats to American
citizens.
And
that citizens. Was that London police guy who was just like, well, you know, if Americans in the UK say something wrong, we're going to bring him to prison. It's like, oh, man. Good luck, buddy.
it is crazy because this is a little side tangent here, but a lot of the neocons and the corporate press, they're really trying to drive a wedge between Donald Trump and Elon Musk right now. There's all these articles that are coming out. It's just like Donald Trump staffers are saying, you know, they use Trump for the victory, but now they can't now the weird guy keeps sticking around, you know, like that type of stuff. Oh, so like they're trying to set this.
They used Elon for the victory.
Yeah. But then also they're saying, but now everybody's saying he's too weird and he just won't leave us alone. And like, they're trying to make it sound like he's like this like autistic kid that just keeps palling around there.
well, he's appearing on all these calls too. Like there was a phone call between Trump and Zelensky, and Elon also happened to be on it. I'm fairly sure.
Yeah.
So he's just like, he's kind of very involved.
Well, they're trying to put this wedge of saying that Trump is too narcissistic to have a powerful guy like Elon around. And they're trying to make it be like, there's two figure in the, it's like, they're trying to get into Trump's head of like trying to find reasons to dislike Elon. But then you see what happened at the UFC and they're just like buddies, like laughing and giggling with each other about the fight. And I'm like, I don't think it's working. I think that they're actually like pals now.
Yeah. We've got a late breaking addition to the
What do we got here?
To the order of operations from Bennett.
Bennett just put something in our notes as we're talking, saying this is important.
It is. It's not really
massive highlight.
It's not really about what we're talking about, but apparently Gates has withdrawn as Attorney General.
Oh really?
What?
Oh, that's said he's breaking becoming a distraction. News.
Yeah, this was 25 minutes ago, so right when we started recording, basically.
I had excellent meetings with senators yesterday. I appreciate their thoughtful feedback and the incredible support of so many. While the momentum was strong, it is clear that my confirmation was unfairly becoming a distraction to the critical work of the Trump fans transition. There is no time to waste on a needlessly protracted Washington scuffle. Thus, I'll be withdrawing my name from consideration to serve as Attorney General. Trump's DOJ must be in place and ready on day one. Interesting.
Oh, shucks.
Interesting. He was him and Tulsi and RFK, in a sense, are the most controversial picks. It's what they're trying to make the most controversial picks. So
that sucks.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I imagine it's there something with the ethics investigation or something like that. It's got to be what he's referring to.
Yeah. Well, they're just going to keep piling more and more stuff on. And it's one of these things, whether or not it's true. But I do understand this. Like, even if all the allegations are false here, it's going to get so bogged down because of it. They might just be like, we got to do somebody else because of it.
They're going to Kavanaugh now at that point.
But I thought that recess appointments and that sort of thing were on the table for some of these more controversial picks. So this seems like maybe it's, well, I don't know. Maybe this is a decision that Gates made that's not so much, you know, something that the Trump administration has said they're going to do. But
I doubt it. I doubt it very much.
It's probably like a mutual decision. Like I think Gates probably understands the game theory too. Like I don't think it's
sure. I'm not sure that Trump had to force him out or something like that. But the dynamic probably was a calculation of the Senate, given the new Senate leadership with Thune, and then talking to Trump. It's like, okay, we can do the X, Y, Z, but we can't do this. And here's why. And then the Trump administration is like, okay, that's not worth it. We don't want to go through a Kavanaugh again.
Well, you like think about it. Even he gets the appointment and the recess appointments, and think about how bogged down he's going to end up being. They're just going to keep throwing more and more stuff at him, just even if he ends up becoming the Attorney General. So
also,
it might just be one of those things where it's like,
Congress at some point has to pass a budget. You can't keep them on recess forever if you're going to cut spending, if you want to do DOGE, really.
Isn't the recess just for the appointments?
Yeah, but you just have that challenge, and they have other appointments they got to do. They got to fill judgeships. They got to fill a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's a challenging
problem. Interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
I just didn't want us to miss that this week. So
no, that's like cool.
I agree. Thanks for letting us know. That's
breaking.
We got the
news.
Breaking news. Do, do, do.
We need a graphic.
All right. Now back to Europe.
All right.
Well, let's move on to
Germany.
I think we finished everything on UK here. Yeah. What's going on with Germany?
So there's a new book coming out called Kaput, and there's a very interesting interview with Wolfgang Munchau. Germany's facing an economic slump. The government is falling apart, and elections are scheduled in February. That's the short of it. I wanted to dive in a little bit here because I think it's interesting. For a long time, the German industrial model was considered the gold standard of Europe. After the World War II, they invested in engineering, and they became an engineering and manufacturing titan. This effort was kind of driven in part by government action, not to like kill off competitors. Oh, that's according to this guy, but by investment. Each, you know, if you had an auto manufacturer, if you're Volkswagen or whatever, there would be a local bank that's basically there, funded by the government, to finance your research so that you can make the best engineered cars. This kind of subsidy basically, in short, resulted in an overinvestment in that area, not diversified investments across the German economy, where they got so narrowly tailored into manufacturing and engineering. Now that we're having the current struggles that they are, new areas of the economy are getting bigger, things like software are becoming more important, less so engineering, they are completely underinvested there. That's that, and so you have things like electric cars. They had, did not bet on electric cars. A lot of that's institutional thinking. But it was also like, well, we do gas cars here, you know, that sort of thing, right? AI, crypto, across the larger economy, there just simply wasn't investment in other areas, and it's caught Germany flat-footed. Very interesting argument around like the difference between free markets with and planned markets, right? Where you're not socialism, you're not owned by the government, but you do have this very clear directional pathway pushing the market in a very specific direction. And when that bet doesn't work out, what happens? And this is a like a case closed, excellent example of the problems of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have these subsidies funneling money into something that doesn't pan out. And then, you know, obviously like the free market would have provided a more open opportunity for people to explore in some of these other areas is kind of what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things he claims is like the angel investors in Germany are leaving Germany. Like they're not sticking around because it's just no opportunity there because there's no innovation culture. They're so institutionalized into these very narrow bandwidths. And to me, the economics precedes the culture in this way, right? You've owned this German industrial model for such a long time. It's been the envy of Europe for such a long time that it's made your culture basically monosyllable on that. And they have to just do that. And they do anything else, it's considered as controversial and outside the norm.
Yeah, you think about Germans and you think of like very orderly, like, you know,
Nazis.
I mean, and
I'm kidding.
I was going to say engineers.
Damn,
but like great technology around that stuff. Are the energy costs that they're facing with like the, you know, the Nord Stream pipeline affecting like the viability of their industrial base as well? Is that a factor?
One of the things that we didn't cover this, I actually hesitated because I knew I was familiar with some of these other problems, but like their capital markets are in chaos. They're like startup and like bottom up markets are in chaos. And then we have things like the Volkswagen factories being shut down. Like this is the first time they've ever shut down a factory, period. America's like open and closing factories every other month, right? Compared to these European auto manufacturers. But this has never happened before. I mean, can you imagine how flat-footed that placed them? Now, some of that is probably that. Like Germany used to produce most of the world's physicists and engineers, nuclear physicists and nuclear engineers. But since Fukushima, they've committed to killing off all their nuclear sector. We've talked a little bit here with Kat. But you should also note that what we didn't really impact was that pretty much precludes them from getting into AI at all. So Germany's kind of stuck with all of the new ways in which the economy is developing in terms of software, in terms of AI and crypto. They can't get access to the energy resources. And then you had the Nord Stream and Russia. And so this is the place where I think it was the most interesting part of this interview with Unheard. Do you have something here, Kyle?
I just looked up. I just kind of asked the question: how much has Germany's economy declined in recent years? And it's saying that the GDP is falling 0.3% year after year, too.
Mm-hmm. Wow!
And he traces this back all the way back to 2015. But what we can see is with developments with Russia, Ukraine, it's accelerated that pathway. So the
energy consumption 7.8% decrease. In the last year.
Wow. Yeah. So green. Jeez. So green.
So green.
Well, and
saving the planet.
And to be clear, what that means, if you're using less energy, that means you're making less stuff. You're not doing as much because everything that's energy intensive, all the things that create value, right? The theory of energy is a theory of the ways in which we take human capabilities of like knowledge and technology and things like that, and we make work out of something that's not human. Gas in the ground or nuclear power. Those things mean that there's exchange off once you don't do that. That means literally less growth.
Yeah.
And once you're there, you're in a desperate situation. So anyways, one of the things we haven't got into in this, because we've talked a little bit about this pivot from Germany, is what is the motivation? I think this guy gives an interesting answer to why they made the nuclear energy to natural gas move.
What did they think would happen? What was this amazing new energy source that was supposed to be flourishing by now?
The idea was that, I mean, gas is relatively relatively cheap. They thought the supply was secure, and they thought that most of the energy would over a longer period of time shift to renewables, which would be even cheaper and even more secure. So the idea was this sort of duality.
That hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened. Well, the renewables are up at 50% of the total supply, so that part went according to plan. The problem is that Germany needs a strong backup, and gas is an expensive backup because Germany now buys the gas on world markets.
So my theory here that I want to get into, and I hope I don't take too much time here, but I do think it's really interesting. It might be a novel contribution, I'm not sure. If you take that and you think through Mike Benn's thesis for the war in Ukraine, okay, wind back. Burisma happens when the son of the vice president gets appointed to a board, right? Doesn't speak the language. Knows nothing about energy policy, but he's in. And then there's the influence peddling part of that. But if we ask him about it, what his public comment was is, I was serving my country. So the theory of Mike Benz is that he is an asset of the left-wing branch of the CIA. Mm-hmm. For an energy play, for energy dominance in Eastern Europe, in their feeding of energy and natural resources to Western Europe, to Germany. So imagine this. Circa 2014, they say, okay, we got this Russian guy in here. We don't like him. He's investigating Burisma. Poroshenko, I believe his name was. We're going to do the Maidan. We're going to install Hunter Biden. We're going to move the formerly nationalized Burisma into the private sector. When we do that, just like what we did in the Russian government-owned industry, moving to private sector, we're going to create that into a new capital market owned by London Finance and New York Finance industry that will then provide. They go to the Germans. They say, "Hey, I know you want to do this stuff. You want to move into this new industry. We can make a lot of money together by if we're successful here." We'll have all this natural gas out of Burisma and out of Eastern Ukraine to sell to Germany. You won't have to go to the Russians. The Russians are just a pit stop on the way to the rest of Europe. And then you'll have many options for buying in an abundance in this energy, natural gas energy sector to then rely on. Nowhere in here do we note that nuclear power is being killed off in order to do something that's more carbon intensive, but let's leave that aside. My theory is that they promised us, the Germans, and said that this will happen. Once that failed with Trump getting impeached because he was going into this and mucking up this operation, and then Russia invades Ukraine, is it throws all of this out. That's why Germany is not making any noise about this. That's why Angela Merkel isn't saying, how dare the Nord Stream pipeline be blown up by Ukrainians or by America. They're just like, well, that's kind of the price you pay, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, because I suspect the play was that. So that's why they overinvest in that in a very irrational way, in a way that doesn't make any sense. Like they knew Russia wasn't, they're in NATO, for God's sakes, an alliance specifically to keep Russia from being able to invade the rest of Europe while they're investing in Russia. Natural gas pipelines.
And it's also one of these things, too, where a lot of the... Because everybody hyper-focuses on Hunter Biden of doing crack and banging hookers.
Yes.
And that's all they could talk about. It was like, no, this is the thing right here that was going on. It's not about that. Like, everybody gets kind of wrapped up in that. But this was obvious back when the New York Post dropped the story and got banned from everything right before the election. This is the type of stuff that was being uncovered at the time. Like I think Mike Benz is completely right in the thesis here, is because this was evident in 2020. Mm-hmm. We knew this in 2020. It's just all of the information about it was getting suppressed. Mm-hmm. And now we can see it in full light.
So I think this what this suggests is that promise, you know, that's made America less reliable to Germany. So, but they can't publicly do anything about that because America funds NATO.
Right.
Right. So that explains all of the reactions now suddenly make sense to me using this theory.
It also makes sense of why Biden was such an important figure that had to be the person that got 2020, like in the running in 2020.
Yeah.
Too. Like it was either somebody that they tried to prop up at that time or Biden. It couldn't be any of the other people in there because this was such a critical part of the infrastructure for, like you said, the left wing wing of the State Department.
Right. And I still think they want to run that play. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, these other parts of Eastern Ukraine are important for natural gas resources, but it's not all of Ukraine, right? And they have other, you know, countries in the Eastern Europe to try to do the same play and make a lot of money, isolate Russia in the long run.
So I just want to make sure I understand your theory because I think that it's important and it makes sense. But so basically you're saying that Germany was divesting from its nuclear power, shutting down plants because there was a deal ostensibly struck between the US and Germany to take over Burisma, privatize it under Western influence, and then sell that natural gas to Germany to power their industry.
Yeah. Burisma is just one of the players in this, but yes,
sure.
At least that.
And then the Nord Stream destruction, and why they're not making noise on that still doesn't make total sense to me. Is that because they were expecting not to be reliant upon Russian gas? Or the U.S. wanted to cut Germany off from Russian gas so that they could sell them?
Something also to add to that is Trump tried to stop Nord Stream from being put in place as well, so that Germany wouldn't be reliant on Russia because he was predicting that there would be a problem that would occur in this of...
In that kind of way, where Russia would then have control over a NATO ally's energy resources. Yeah. So can you just clarify, is that right, my summary of that?
Yeah, I think that's part of the overall battle that's happening where... I think that the motivation for Nord Stream was to remove the temptation from the Germans to turn back on that natural gas when things like Volkswagen can't get enough energy and the economic situation started to decline. Because when he says backup, what he really means is base load. And the problem with natural green energy is it's just unreliable for base load. So if you have a huge manufacturing center sector, base load is the most unreliable. You can't melt steel beams create steel. With solar power,
right,
it's not abundant enough. It's too expensive. So therefore, you go the other direction. You need something base load like nuclear or natural gas. So my case here is that Nord Stream was a backup plan, right, to remove that temptation from the Germans. So now they have to go in the direction of the other Eastern. And there are a couple others. If you look at Mike Benz's work on this, and I forget them off the bat, Burisma's not the only one. There's a couple other across Hungary and Ukraine and other places in Eastern Europe to direct that natural gas going into Germany. And therefore, it's like temporary pain to get the long-term output of what the State Department, and what I assume is the Merkel, because she's been in forever, agreement.
She left that direction. In 2021, though.
Yeah, but she was in from that time period of when it's important.
During the, yeah.
So basically, it was also, I mean, sort of a play to damage Russia by preventing them from making money selling the West their resources. Mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
Yeah. And then on top of that, right now, America's making money hand over fist selling natural gas to Germany because it's way more expensive coming from America.
Yeah.
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 And then what he says, natural gas, international natural gas, what he means is America and other areas of the world that supply it by a tanker, right? Tanker trucks full of natural gas that they then drop off and
or ships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, not by pipelines, which are way, way, way cheaper and more efficient.
For sure. Interesting. What else is going on in Germany?
And I don't think it should be undermined, too, that the February election is substantial there, too. So that's coming around the corner. They get into a lot of the AfD, which we cover a little bit, like Deutschland für Deutschland.
Ausländer raus. Ausländer raus.
That song.
Now the song is stuck in Kyle's head for another week.
It was gone for months, and now it's back.
Welcome.
It's back, baby.
Welcome
Fascinating
back.
Here is AfD, which is, it's controversial about whether or not they're a populist right or how to really to interpret them. Taking the American lens too closely maybe is false in some way, but there are some interesting parallels. Their strongest in post-industrial areas that are suffering the most right now under the decline of energy abundance. What does it sound like? The American South and post-industrial Ohio and places like that, right?
So when you say they're the strongest in, what do you mean?
Like that's where their support is the strongest.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. So like labor, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, labor and just the working class.
Sure.
Those areas where you see declining, you know, prosperity,
right,
are the areas that are turning furthest to the right.
Yeah.
So because to be clear, the CMDU, Angela Merkel's party, or CDU, I can't, yeah, is has been in power for a very long time, right? So they're also a right wing in the European sense, but these guys are further to the right. They're more likely to be not hostile to Russia, and more likely to be, if not friendly to Russia.
Are they sort of like an analog to the America First movement, just sort of like the German First movement, if you will?
Yeah, I think there's a sense in which that's true, especially when it comes to international relations in NATO's aggressive posture to Russia, right? At minimum, they're just like the peace group, right? They're like working class people who don't want to go to war with Russia.
They just want to focus on
domestic issues, domestic like issues, energy abundance, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Having jobs.
Now, they are more socialist.
Being able to turn the lights on.
That's a great thing to have.
Yeah. So what's interesting, what makes America First and the MAGA movement interesting and unique is the combination of working class appeal with free market economics, right? Trump is courted by, you know, the Koch network to the taxpayer union to these other things. So they want to create abundance by free markets and low taxes and low business regulatory environment. AFT is not necessarily that way. They're much more, we want to create working class prosperity by raising the minimum wage and forcing people to do more union contracts and stuff like that. So it's different. So you mm-hmm. shouldn't analogize that too closely, but it's a similar motive at mm-hmm. minimum. So along with that, what we've had, and I wanted to report this when it came out, but you know, it just didn't fit our stories at the time, was this effort by current legislators to ban the party.
AFD.
Yeah, AFD. I have an article here, Kyle, for review of this. Now, a lot of this is done in the framework of AFD's The Rise of the Fascists Again. So they're making this case to ban the existence of the party before the February election. They started this in October.
Because they're Nazis.
Yes.
Ostensibly.
Yeah. Well, and this, but they're only not like, well, and there's a sense there too when it comes to their view, like the emotional view of outsiders, right? So they're very pro immigration restriction, further than Donald Trump would be. Like in America, it's impossible to imagine a party that could talk about at a party meeting someplace a concept called re-immigration, which is where you take actual people who are legal immigrants who have attained citizenship, and because they weren't born there and they're not Germans ethnically, shipping them to their original country.
Wow.
That's way further out.
Yikes.
Yeah. But that's a claim by this author, Munchau, that I'm not sure is fair. That might be some party members. The party's actual public platform isn't that radical. But it is definitely anti-immigrant, right? And from the working class Bernie Sanders point of view, as far as I can see.
Yeah. It's one of those things, though, too, like within the MAGA movement is you have people kind of on the fringes of it that are just anti-immigration entirely, when actually in the average opinion of the MAGA movement is just kind of really getting rid of illegal immigration. And Trump's official policies is kind of like trying to ease and make it better so that we can figure out who is proper immigrants and stuff like that, like, which is a way more moderate position. But you do have the people on the very fringes, and then you'll have people go and interview those people on the very fringes and be like, that's what the MAGA movement's all about. Yeah, right. That I'm kind of getting that here is that's probably an element of this.
But this guy, he brands himself as conservative in the American mm-hmm. sense. So I'm not sure if that's really where he's at. There might be true that there's a greater proportion of this wing of German politics to separate himself from the CDU is more like that, more radical.
Yeah. But also Germany does have a history. So there could be that too.
There's also that. Right?
Like there is that.
And I want to note this too. And I think I have this tweet from Uber Boyo that I think is really interesting in just summarizing where Europe's at. In 2008, Europe was as wealthy as a country, produced as much as America did. And the separation from the 2008 financial crisis to then COVID response to where America's at today, and the difference there is so substantial. It's so wild. I mean, look at that graph.
So this is a screenshot of a tweet by Robin Brooks saying, defining feature of the recovery after 2008 is that the Eurozone fell permanently behind the U.S. Preliminary signs are this is happening again. The U.S. is within 1% of its pre-COVID GDP trend, which is 2.2% annual growth. The Eurozone is 2.5% below a much weaker 1.2% trend. So those lines are very, very divergent.
And compounded over time, that gap widens.
Now, most of Europe, their identity is that they're a first world country, just like America. And the further they fall behind, to what degree is that going to cause this kind of radical right wing, left and right response? I think is real. It's a real problem that they have to grapple with.
Bit of an identity crisis. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a common number that's often looked at of what usually constitutes uprisings and rebellions and riots and things like that. And it usually comes to a point where it's like, if a household's food is 20% of their income, then that becomes a major signifying factor of like massive instability and massive political shifts that happen. And we've been dancing around those lines in a lot of these countries for a while now.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And that could explain a lot of just how fervent the response was on placing controls on things like fertilizer.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why people respond so aggressively to that, to the point where they're dumping manure in the, you know, outside of Parliament in France and stuff like that. Like it's a different sort of like we, in America, we're much more like, oh, they have some complaints, right? They're like, no, we're fighting for existence here in a lot of ways because these people are so caught up in the climate stuff that they just don't see how their policies are affecting everyday people.
Yeah. Sounds like a bunch of insurrectionists to me.
Well, I guess then in positive news, we can take a shift back to Argentina. Milei was in America and he's done some podcasts. He had some meetings. He met with Elon Musk and Vivek to talk about Doge. He met with Donald Trump. And then he did the Lex Fridman podcast, and it was a pretty interesting podcast. And they also did this cool like auto translate YouTube thing where you could listen to it in Spanish or in English. It's kind of cool.
It was impressive for AI, especially. Yeah. I thought that was one of the coolest parts because you could really hear the AI did a good job like replicating inflection in a sense, like where he was passionate, the words became more passionate sounding, where he was kind of more analytical, it sounded more analytical. It was really cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great interview.
So I want to start off with his austerity and what that meant for Argentina, kind of what he's done and the approach that he took.
It was crucial to end fiscal deficit. One of the things we promised during the campaign had been to reduce the number of ministries, and indeed we reduced to less than half the number of ministries, because we went to 9 ministries, today we have 8. We have also laid off a large number of civil employees. Today I can say that we've already dismissed about 50,000 of them. And we practically don't renew any contracts unless the positions are absolutely necessary. At the same time, we have stopped public works and we have eliminated discretionary transfers to the provinces. We have also diluted public sector wages. Also, we have eliminated economic subsidies by restoring utility rates to the right levels. And in this context, we achieved fiscal deficit as far as the Treasury is concerned. This is very important because in the last 123 years, Argentina had a deficit for 113 of them. And in the 10 years, it did not have a deficit because it was not paying the debt. So that was absolutely false. And they told us it would be impossible to do that.
Dang.
Yeah.
So he's getting stuff done down there.
And just to translate a little bit here further, ministries in this case means is departments.
Right.
That is ending the Department of Education. That is ending entire blocks of functions of their government.
50,000 jobs.
Positions in this case, that's public employees who are let go.
Yeah.
Transfers block is pretty much what we do in the United States with block grants. Now, Argentina had a far more corrupt system of that where it was literally up to the bureaucrat to decide what they're for, and they could just issue that money without much interaction. Their executive is definitely much stronger in that, which was more rife with corruption because of that.
Makes sense.
But block grants are a major thing in the United States. So if you ended that or if you changed that substantially, that would make a huge difference as well.
So you would think ending 50,000 public sector positions would have a sort of negative impact on the economy, right? Because those are unemployed people. Mm-hmm. But things are looking better. How is that possible?
Well, they're looking better in a sense, right? They're looking better by some measures, but not all measures, right? So, like, for example, you have all these people claiming that poverty went up. Well, if you're formerly 50,000 people out of, they have millions of people in their economy. Like, it's a big, big, big place. But still, that's people who are probably one of the higher wage roles being let go. That's going to increase the amount of people who are low income for a time as markets re-equilibrate to the new reality. So there's a lot of moving parts here. So it's really difficult. Actually, Soho Forum today, this morning, released a debate on Argentina and whether or not Milei's reforms have made it better or not. The con side pretty much relies on those statistics. They say, well, poverty rate's gone up. Doesn't matter what everything else is happening. Doesn't matter what happened before.
Yeah, but all the other rates, though, too, are like,
well, and also
like inflation's gone way down, you know, and that was the problem in Argentina was hyperinflation.
Yeah. Well, and that's what hyperinflation hides, right? So the first people to get the money are the people who are the folks whose money is created, right? So the government creates new money and then gives it to bureaucrats who then go spend in the economy. And they say that's stimulating the economy. Well, that money had to be created and that increases prices. So the further you are away from that bureaucrat, the more you're being punished by the rise in prices due to the entry of that new money in the supply, not being rewarded. So a lot of that rise in poverty is because we're actually seeing what the actual poverty rate was in Argentina before. It was just hidden by inflationary spending.
Haven't we seen prices for consumer goods come down as well in Argentina?
Yeah. In the sense that they're growing slower. Does that make sense? So if you had a much higher rate, they're now going up lower. And we'll circle down the end and kind of look at the that data.
So something that is pretty impressive, I've never listened to him in long form before. Like, I've only just, you know, seen the clips that everybody's seen and then seen what has been said about him, you know. I am pretty impressed by his economic knowledge, like how much actual economic girth the guy's got. And him being able to rattle off, you know, all these different books, all of the major, all of, in my opinion, the best economists, and use them as his influences. You know, he accredits Mises and Rothbard and Hayek and Friedman, and you know, all of the greats. You know, and also pinpointing that he himself says that Rothbard's probably the best, which is kind of, I like that.
Based.
Very based. So it's just impressive. Like, actually, my takeaway of the interview was he's all the things I like about Trump, but he's also read a book.
Yeah. And that's kind of great. Yeah. His story of finding the Austrians was really cool.
Yeah.
I really like that. And he bought 30 books and read them all. Like, that's feels very familiar.
Yeah.
So he has some advice for Americans, and specifically the Doge efforts.
Because he met with Elon and Vivek, too. So, and this is after the fact of that meeting.
What advice would you give to Elon and Vivek about how to do it in the United States?
Just cut to the chase. Cut to the chase. Simple as that. I'll tell you a story and you're going to love it.
Very Trumpian. Yeah.
Currently in Argentina, due to the political balance we've achieved, we have had certain powers delegated from Congress to the executive branch, and therefore we can resolve it by decree. The deregulation minister, Federico Sturzenegger, in his ministry, shows a counter that displays in front of everyone there. He displays the number of days, all right? During which the delegated powers will continue to be valid. Therefore, he has a whole deregulation division, also a public spending cut division, and government structure reduction division. And he also has an elite corps that's cleaning up all of the laws that hinder the economic system and progress. And every day, he removes between 1 and 5 economic restrictions. So my advice would be for them to go all the way, to push it to the very limit, and do not give up. Do not let down their guard. Furthermore, that agenda does not have political purpose, because at the end of the day, you are removing privileges. Of course, there will be people complaining, but those are people. These are people who are losing privileges, so they will have to explain to society why they are keeping those privileges. And that is quite uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
I can't wait. I can't wait for that to happen here.
Well, you know what's kind of interesting, kind of coming back to Doge here in America, is Vivek, just a couple days ago, he announced that he is suspending his podcast. He has the Truth Podcast, and he is suspending that. And him and Elon are starting a podcast together called the Dogecast, where they're going to be transparent about all of the things that they're going in and looking at and cutting and giving the explanations of why they're cutting it. And it's just like, it's crazy that we're at this point right now, where you have Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy doing a podcast together about cutting everything, and then that being the source for them actually cutting things for the presidency. It's crazy.
So one thing here, just to translate beyond again, decree in this case would be executive order. So it's obviously a different structure, right? In order to create a new position like this, a new ministry of sorts, his ministry of economic
reduction or whatever,
or regulation reduction, is something that he can do as president, right? So what's happened in Argentina's history is that they've consolidated so much power in their executive that he has a much larger range to be able to just make changes happen. America's more constrained. When he was elected, I actually remember us speculating, well, how much can he actually fall through on this? On, we don't really know enough about Argentina. What looks like, you know, the opposition over the last 50 years have so gone over their skis with this. It is really, it's kind of shocking the degree to which their executive branch can just completely change direction. Now, can Trump emulate that? Executive orders are more constrained in the United States, but still have a lot of power. So
yeah. Well, it makes you wonder, you know, like we've talked about, a lot of the things that Trump can get done here quickly are by executive order, but they're not necessarily as permanent because they're not legislated. Is there any expectation that once Milei kind of gets a lot of these onerous regulations out of the way, that he will try to return some authority to the legislative branch in Argentina so that they can persist potentially beyond his tenure?
That's a good question. And I don't know if he's has term limits or how that works, but it's a very interesting one.
Well, and I imagine if the results continue to pour in and they do continue to be so beneficial and inflation does come down and prices do come down, he'll have another re-election, at least however many they get. I don't know exactly how many they get in Argentina, but
yeah, exactly. So that's the, you know, and this is a promises made, promises kept moment, right? Like he's coming to America and saying like, no, I became an international afuera, or is that
afuera?
Which I actually have it playing in the background right now. He's speaking in Spanish, but it's him going down the board. It's the famous viral clip of him being like, "Ministry of Transportation out, Ministry of Health out," and afuera. He's just pulling off all the the ministries, all of the departments off the board. The thievery of politics is over. Long live freedom! Damn it!
I love that. And him becoming a meme in that is such a it's exercising global leadership in that sense. And, you know, and this plays out too in the statistics, right? And you were asking about that. We do have some charts of the CPI. That's the change in Argentina, right? So, and you can see the trajectory change from 2020 to 2024 and then how drastic it's been.
That's inflation, aggregate inflation rate. So it was kind of stable around 5% and then starts to tick up in 22 and 23. It gets all the way up to 25% in 24 and it's crashed down now to like, what is that, 3% ish?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's pretty remarkable.
2.7.
Yeah.
Wow. And it was at the height in December of 2023, 25.5%.
Wow. And noting that's month to month.
That's crazy.
That's crazy, right? So, I feel like the lesson there is like the radicalism, what the American press calls austerity. And, you know, when he says go all the way, dive all the way in with Doge, commit, and just suffer the consequences, because one of the things he talks about a lot in this is like the press in Argentina is just terrible. It's been savaging.
Says 85% of the press is corrupt.
Is
the way that he defined it.
I'd say it's about the same here.
I was going to say the same thing.
So, but that we're going to see that this next 4 years are going to be defined by people saying these austerity measures are too much. Look, all these unemployed people. Look at all this. All that kind of stuff is going to happen. So we need to inoculate that word,
right?
I don't think you can really, you know. You have to address that before they can bring it up. And that's going to be what I think the next year is going
to
be defined.
Yeah, people have to understand there has to be a correction in order for the economy to actually get healthy and, you know, prosper.
And that's what you see by these numbers. Numbers themselves are not the economy. The economy is a set of organic relationships as people solve needs together. That's what the economy is. So when they say, you know, poverty's gone up, they're not looking at people's actual welfare, looking at a measurement of income by numbers that are affected by the inflation rate.
Yeah. It's also another thing, and maybe a critique of democracy right there, is sometimes in order to heal, you have to kind of rip the Band-Aid off. And that initial thing could be painful, but it's going to be much better in the long run. And all of the incentives in this democratic system right now are no pain, no pain. We're going to just keep covering up. We're going to just keep taking on more debt so that we can pay for all the stuff, and then we're going to give you more stuff and then take on more debt, and then it just keeps climbing and climbing and climbing. Right. But there's no real incentive for the long game, because that's not how politics works. You got to get elected in 2 years.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Americans love comfort, and we love free stuff. And we're in a fortunate position with the world reserve currency that we don't feel the majority of the pain from our money printing.
We export our pain out.
We export the pain to countries like Argentina and other places. So, yeah, well, it'll be very interesting to see how Doge does in the
really,
coming years.
Really quickly before we wrap up, the president of Argentina can be reelected for a second term. And if they have served two consecutive terms, they may be elected again after an interval of one term.
Oh,
okay, you keep rotating him back in. Try to get another guy that's like Malay, and you just kind of rotate him back and forth.
So I don't know if it's like he can then go for two more terms after that one interval, or if it's only one more term, with a total of three. But
well, he'd probably be too old.
Wait, I'm reading that as two terms.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm reading that.
All right. Well, that's it. Some good news, some white pills.
Absolutely. Well, we'll just hope that we're here with you again next week, and World War III hasn't progressed to nuclear annihilation. Not to end it on a black pill, but we hope you're...
Jesus, Joe.
You know, look, I got to keep it real, all right? We can't forget the fact that the world could end at any moment.
You know, it is kind of funny is just maybe a quick little side note is when I was listening to, I believe it was the Pete Hegseth interview on Sean Ryan had made this point of he thought that what like the enemies of like both within and also abroad would try to escalate things right around the inauguration date of Trump, where everything is very chaotic in that moment. Because if you're ever going to do it, it'd be right in that moment before Trump kind of
takes the reins.
Yeah.
Yeah. We shall see. It'll be an interesting time, and we're glad to have you watching with us. We are going to do our skiff episode for members only. So if you're not yet a member, go to humanreactionpod.com to become one and get access to our exclusive content. Once again, it's been Human Reaction. For David Rand, Kyle Mack, Bennett on the buttons, I'm Joe Sheehan. See you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember,
I used to love Mumford & Sons. Back in high school, I listened to them all the time. They were my climbing playlist.
Hell yeah, brother.
Hell yeah, brother. Yeah, brother.